99%ers. This is Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. All right, today we're going to do our round robin once again of the major developments in the U.S. and the global economy. And let's start right from the get-go with corporate tax cutting rolls on. Well, you know, in previous shows, we've talked on multiple occasions about the Trump tax cut, $5 trillion for investors and businesses and the wealthy 1%, $2 trillion tax increases. This is over 10 years, of course, for the middle class and eliminating deductions and exemptions, leaving a $3 trillion net result, which is then by the median Trump administration reduced to $1.5 trillion based on some absurd assumptions about U.S. economic growth over the next 10 years at 3 to 4% every year with no recession, reduced to $1.5 trillion from the $3 trillion net. Okay, so we've talked about that. But, you know, this tax-cutting machine has continued to roll on. The Republicans and Trump aren't satisfied with the $5 trillion. No, they want more, and they're getting it. Well, how so? Well, first of all, the latest move is in Congress for the next budget bill coming later this year to make the Trump tax cuts permanent. You know, they're supposed to be only for 10 years. And what they often don't report is that it's kind of front-loaded. And in the seventh year of the 10-year, taxes for the middle class will actually start to rise. The taxes are cuts are very minimal for the middle class, but starting in 2024, I think it is, that the taxes will actually rise on the middle class, but they will get even bigger for the 1% in businesses and corporations. Well, they want to make that trend permanent so that taxes will continue to rise on the middle class, working class, and will continue to decline on the very rich, the 1% wealthiest households, which are investors and professional investors and their institutions, hedge funds, private equity firms, etc., and corporations. You see, because multinational corporations are really a form of financial institution now. One third of all their investments are in financial markets. They're kind of bank, investment banks, you see. And their shareholders are their clients. Okay, so a front-loaded arrangement this year. And by the way, the front-loading benefit for the average taxpayer is phony because of the way they manipulated the first year in the payroll deduction. People will get an actual little bit of a bigger taste in the tax cut this year. But that goes away next year. Your 2018 taxes, you know, that little trick will disappear and the tax cut will start to fade for the middle class and go out altogether after 6 or 7 years and your taxes will begin to rise. But for investors, it will continue to balloon. Well, they're going to make all that permanent, you see. And the talk is a a Trump tax cut too, 2.0, whatever. Yeah. Another $650 billion in tax cuts for capital gains. You see, what they did in this last tax cut was they left the capital gains, the dividend tax, carried interest tax cuts pretty much where they were. They didn't touch capital gains, which should have been raised, but they didn't touch them. Well, now they're going to go and cut them even more, $650 billion. Oh, but that's not all. News just this past week that big corporations, Fortune 500, 1500, whatever, will be allowed to deduct their pension plan contributions at the old 35% corporate tax rate that they never paid, instead of the new 21% corporate tax. Yeah. Didn't know that, did you? That when companies make contributions to pension plans, they get to write that off from their taxes on an even one-for-one basis. But workers don't. No, when they have to make contributions to their pension funds, they don't get to deduct it. Businesses also do the same, you know, with their contributions to the health care plans. Didn't know that, did you? Yeah, big, big, hundreds of billions of dollars of tax reductions from company contributions to pension funds and health care plans. Workers don't get to do it for their contributions. Well, that's a, you know, maybe may not be a huge tax cut to allow them to continue 35% deduction from their tax bill for their contributions to pension funds. But it's certainly tens of billions, the difference between 21% and 35%. And we continue, they continue, by the way, chipping away at Obamacare ACA. You can see the reason they hated Obamacare was that there was $592 billion in taxes on investors and businesses. And that's why the Koch brothers and others funded all the opposition to the ACA Obamacare. It was the tax cuts or tax hikes, stupid, that they hated. And now they're chipping away at that. They couldn't repeal ACA last year, but they're chipping away at it. Yeah, the insurance, the tax on insurance companies was suspended. There were other provisions as well. The device, medical device tax was suspended. The mandate, business mandate was suspended by Obama. You know, all these things are chipping away at the funding base of the ACA Obamacare. And now just last week, they put forward a alternative health insurance program called association plans. Association plans will reduce the liability for companies. They join together and they, quote, negotiate collectively. The companies get to negotiate collectively. New health insurance coverage for their employees. But the plans they're negotiating will have huge deductibles and co-pays for the workers. Less cost for them, less liability for the companies, but huge $3,000-$5,000 deductibles, and who knows what the co-pays will be. It'll be health insurance alternative plans in name only. Anyway, that's all part of the continuing ripoff in corporate investor taxations, right? Okay. All right, what else of news? Well, as long as we're talking about pensions and workers, let's talk about the Teamster UPS contract. You know, another example of concession bargaining that's destroying American unions. There's 260,000 workers at UPS. The average union wage for full-time permanent workers there is $37 an hour, approximate. Part-time workers only get $13 an hour. You know, this is part of this concession bargaining that's been going on for decades. The Teamsters, like many other unions, agree to two-tier wages and two-tier benefits. You know, dual citizens. Unions never did that, would never agree to that before neoliberalism. This all starts under Reagan, you know, this whole two-tier concession bargaining. Well, there's been two-tier a long time in the Teamster and other contracts. Big difference. You know, part-time workers only get $13 an hour, less than, well, barely a third that the full-time workers get. But the companies are hiring more and more part-timers and what's called contingent workers. In other words, not just part-time, but temp, contract workers, on-call, etc. This is a big trend. You know, there's maybe 40, 50 million now out of the 160 million workforce who are what we call contingent. Well, this recent, or just announced, hasn't even been ratified yet, UPS Teamsters contract covering 100,000 workers plus calls for a wage increase of $4.15 over 5 years. Well, that's about a 2.2% increase over the average wage of $37, approximately. 2.2%. Well, inflation is running at 2.7, 2.8%. So, in real terms, the Teamsters are negotiating a wage reduction once again of at least a half a percent every year, compounded, in the real purchasing power of wages. And we don't even know how much the cut in the part-time wage will be. This is only the full-time employees for $4.15 over 5 years. Ah, but that's not all. You see, the Teamsters contract also agrees to a new category called hybrid drivers. Not part-time, but hybrid. Hybrid drivers will only work on weekends, Saturday, Sunday, because UPS is planning to expand its deliveries on Saturdays and Sundays. Why? Because they're going to get more business. Why? Because Congress is going to privatize and cut the postal worker service even further. So they're going to pick up more business. Okay, so if they hire special workers, hybrid workers, undoubtedly at lower pay than the full-time permanent employees. What that means is that the current full-time permanent employees at UPS will not get overtime work, will not get overtime pay at the full $37 an hour pay rate. In other words, their take-home pay is going to get cut. Yes, they won't work overtime. Their pay will be cut. Other people will be hired, not at overtime rates, probably less than $37 an hour, not at overtime rates. So the total wage bill that UPS will pay will decline even further. In other words, full-time workers will get a pay cut because of no overtime pay, and that half a percent per year real-time wage reduction in this contract will be supplemented by a further reduction in wages due to elimination of overtime earnings for the full-time workers. You see, this is what I call moving the money around, having negotiated years ago for years contracts for unions before all the concession bargaining bullshit began. I know how management moves the money around. You know, okay, we'll make it look like you're getting a wage increase here, but we're going to take the money back away here. But you go sell this contract to your members focusing on the wage increase part, but don't tell them about the wage cut part. And we'll be happy with that because we'll end up, we management, we'll end up not having to pay any more than we're paying now. And the workers will think they got something because that's what you're going to tell them, right? Well, that's the bullshit game that's been played for decades. And it looks like Teamsters and Negotiators are playing the same bullshit game, concession bargaining game. They're really not going to get $4.15. You know, they're moving the money around. It'll probably be a push for 5 years while inflation continues to rise even faster. I even wrote a song about it years ago. Moving the Money Around was the title. Okay, let's move on. Another important event announcement was the U.S. Federal Reserve Central Bank is conducting its annual dog and pony show called Bank Stress Tests. Yeah, every spring, the Fed does a test of whether the big banks can survive another financial crisis like 2008. In fact, these stress tests began in 2008, and they were phony then from the very beginning. They were designed in the middle of the financial crash to show that, oh, the banks weren't as bad off as they really appeared to be. Go ahead, investors, and invest in the banks. You know, put your money, your capital in the banks and bail out the banks, investors, by buying their stock. It's okay. They're fine. Our stress test shows that they're okay. You know, they did a lot of that phony stuff back then in 2008-09 to make the banks look better off than they were. Congress joined in and suspended what's called mark-to-market accounting. In other words, mark-to-market accounting said you got to tell the truth in your balance sheets and income statements. You've got to show that, you know, really what is the case, the situation of your company. You can't lie about it. Well, Congress said, you don't have to use mark-to-market accounting. You can lie about it. And that fit nice with the stress test because then they lied about it. And by the way, you know, big Democrat liberals, you know, like Barney in the House, pushed that. Oh, yeah, let's suspend mark-to-market accounting. You see, it was that suspension and the phony stress tests that sucked in more investors and the Federal Reserve that started bailing the banks out at trillions of dollars that really stabilized the banks and prevented another 1930s-like global depression. But the Fed just continued bailing them out for another 7 years with zero interest rates and quantitative easing, buying up the bad bonds and stock. Not stocks, but bad bonds. In Japan, they bought up stocks. Right? In other words, bailed out the private investors. Took up their subprime mortgage bonds that had collapsed 15 cents on the dollar and bought them off them and took that debt on its own Federal Reserve balance sheet to the tune of $4.5 to $6 trillion. That's how the banks got bailed out. But the stress tests played a role, as did mark-to-market accounting suspension. Okay, so what does that have to do with the stress test this past week? Well, as I said, the stress tests are phony. Well, how are they phony? What do you mean? Well, the Fed tells these banks exactly what the parameters are for them to pass the tests. And then the banks shuffle their accounting around in order to satisfy the Fed parameters. It's like giving students the answers of the test before they take it. That's why they're phony. They're not real. They're designed to make the banks look like they're okay. Well, the banks have been okay for some time. But why is it still going on? Well, because the Fed held back the approval of paying dividends, allowing the banks to pay dividends and buy back their stock from their shareholders unless they pass the stress test, right? And some of the banks, of course, even though they knew what the parameters were, you know, had trouble reaching those parameters. Well, you know, only if they passed, satisfied the Fed say, okay, you can give dividends to your shareholders now. The banks are planning, according to a report last week, to pay out $170 billion in dividends and stock buybacks. $170 billion. That's just for the 22 biggest banks, by the way. All the medium-sized banks have been exempted from the stress tests already. That was passed here earlier this year. They're exempted. You know, we're talking about maybe, you know, 50 to 100 medium-sized community banks here. So we're left with only the 35 biggest banks, who own 80% of all bank assets, by the way. And the 22 of those 35 are now planning to give $170 billion in dividend and buybacks. By the way, on the show we've reported, other estimates of dividend payouts and stock buybacks combined this year of about $1.3 trillion. U.S. corporations are giving back $1.3 trillion this year to their shareholders. You know, in the previous 6 years, they gave about $1 trillion every year for 6 years. You know, that's how you get income inequality. You freeze wages, right, pretty much, and then you allow the rich, you know, to accumulate $1 trillion more a year in stock buybacks and dividend payouts. Well, this year it's going up even more, 1.3 trillion. Well, why is that? Trump tax cuts. That's why. Big windfall of hundreds of billions of dollars this year alone. And then, as I said earlier, you know, Trump tax cut 2.0 coming with $650 billion more cuts in capital gains, which is, right, stock buybacks, dividend payouts, foreign exchange speculation, derivatives, etc. You know, even so, it appears that some of these big banks, particularly the shadow banks, the investment banks, are still pretty shaky. As part of these stress tests, banks have to keep what's called Tier 1 capital, in other words, essentially liquid capital, cash, on hand in the event of a crisis. And the Fed says, well, you know, your Tier 1 capital ratio has to be at least 4.5%, which is pretty damn low. Well, last year, the capital ratio for the 22 big banks was 9.2%. But this year, it's down to 7.9%. It's declining. And banks like Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, investment banks, which have the habit of taking riskier investments, they like to loan everything out if they can, right? Their capital ratio in Goldman Sachs is only 3.1% and Morgan Stanley 3.3%. So they are below the Fed's low threshold of 4.5%. We'll see if the Fed allows them to make dividend payouts nonetheless. Well, you want to bet that Goldman Sachs is going to be able to do it? Well, you know, who's heading up the U.S. Treasury? Steve Mnuchin, an ex-CEO of Goldman Sachs. Yes. You want to bet that Goldman gets to distribute more dividends and buy back more of its stock, even though its capital ratio is only 3.1% below the Fed limit, which is already, you know, ridiculously low? Yes, yes, yes. Answer to all that. Right. You know, the Fed's worst case scenario on which these stress tests are based and these capital ratio numbers are based. Here's the worst case scenario, right? The Fed would define a worst case financial crisis where the bank loss, loan losses are $429 billion. Well, hell, in 2008, it was trillions. So only $429 billion? The unemployment rate would be 10%. Well, the U6 unemployment rate was 18% during the last crisis. The decline in GDP would be 7.5%. Well, you know, in the 6 months between the fourth quarter of 2008, first quarter of 2009, the GDP dropped 15%. That's their worst case. You know, the next worst case will be far worse than that worst case. Well, that 4.5% capital ratio, tier one ratio, is based upon that definition of a worst case. So if the worst, true worst case was far worse, the banks would have to keep more than 4.5%, at least double that. And that means all the banks now at 7.9% are well below a realistic capital ratio they would have to keep to be able to survive the next financial crisis. So much for the Federal Reserve Bank, phony bank stress tests, and all that other BS. By the way, as long as we're talking about central banks, what about the other central banks? What are they doing? You know, the Fed raised rates again, didn't it? Yeah. Federal funds rate, the benchmark rate based on which all of their interest rates change and fluctuate, went up to 2%. And according to the Fed, two more rate increases this year, 2.5%, and three more next year, which means we're well over 3% for the base federal funds rate. Well, as I've been saying, it's worth repeating one more time, is that the federal funds rate cannot hit 3%, probably not even 2.5%, without precipitating a credit crunch, which will throw the economy into a recession. And if it's going to raise rates two more times this year, which it says it is, and then next year, it will precipitate a recession next year, 2019. I say precipitate, not cause, you see. Precipitate. Interest rates don't cause recessions. They push the economy into a recession. The causes are much more fundamental and broad-based. Okay, so the Fed is raising rates. And as I said, this is causing havoc in emerging market economies in the rest of the world, because if when U.S. rates rise, the dollar rises. And when the dollar rises, currencies of these other economies decline proportionally. And when their economies decline, investors want to get out of a currency that's falling, because that means the value of their assets is falling. So they sell those assets and they sell that currency and they buy dollars, drives up the dollar, drives down their own currency even more. It's called capital flight. And capital flight causes import inflation. At the same time, these other emerging market central banks raise their interest rates to stop the capital flight, which causes a recession in their country, so they end up with stagflation, rising unemployment, and rising inflation. Well, that process is beginning in the emerging markets as we talk, and we've had shows on that. As the dollar rises, because interest rates by the Fed rise. The two are strongly linked. Well, what about the impact on other advanced economies like in Europe and Japan with this, as a result of this Fed rate hike and dollar rise? What happens there? Well, something of the same nature. You see, if interest rates are rising and the U.S. economy is growing, then investors in Europe, including U.S. investors that were in Europe, right, see an economy that's stagnating in Europe, which it is now, or falling in recession in Japan, which it is now, they're going to take their money capital out of those economies and send it to the U.S., which is going to exacerbate the economic problems in those countries and fuel further rate hikes and bond price increases in the U.S. as they move their money back to the U.S. So, you know, the Fed and its actions is having a strategic impact on the rest of the world, not just emerging markets, but advanced economies as well, and on the economy here in the United States eventually as well. Well, you all know I've been predicting that we're going to have a recession here in the U.S. next year. Well, others agree with me increasingly, not the majority, but increasingly. Even Greenspan, you know, Alan Greenspan, he says the economy is already slowing. He already sees it happening. And he says, quote, "I don't see how we get out of it," unquote. His answer, of course, is let's take the money from grandma and grandpa. Now, let's cut Social Security. That's what their answer is. It's not let's take some of this multi-trillion-dollar tax cuts and use it to spend on creating jobs in the U.S. No. That's not their solution. Their solution is to take it out on the hide of the average American middle class and working class person, you see. That's their solution. So, well, what are the other central banks doing in these advanced economies? Well, the ECB, European Central Bank, just signaled they're not going to stop their QE. In other words, there was some talk that they might raise their interest rates as well, following the U.S., and thereby slow this money capital outflow problem that's slowing their economy. Well, the ECB had a meeting last week, too, and it said, oh, well, we're not going to do that until September 2019, maybe. So in other words, they're going to continue their quantitative easing bond buying program, buying up government bonds and corporate bonds throughout Europe. The problem is they're buying up the bonds mostly of countries that don't need their bonds subsidized. The countries that need it, support particularly, are in Southern Europe, especially Italy now. They're not going to do that. They're going to continue their quantitative easing. I think it's like, it was like $80 billion a month, euro equivalent of $80 billion of purchasing of bonds. They're buying up all the bonds all over. That's why they have to buy corporate bonds, because the government bonds are being bought up. And they reduced it, I think, to 30 or 50 billion. I forget what the number is. Monthly purchasing of bonds. That's the central bank, ECB bank, right? Which will keep interest rates quite low in Europe, near zero, where they have been for years and years now. Well, the Bank of Japan says it's not going to change its bond buying or its QE program either. And they're keeping rates at negative 0.1%, but negative. In other words, you know, you got to pay the banks, you got to pay the government to put money in bonds in Japan. And in Japan, the central bank is not only buying up bonds, corporate and government, but they're buying up stocks. Yeah, they're keeping the stock market boosted. The Swiss National Bank is keeping interest rates at -0.75, -0.75. So everywhere else in the world, they're not raising rates. And in U.S., we're rushing to raise interest rates, which are going to slow and are slowing certain sectors of our real economy already. Autos, you know, residential market, except for the high end, which is funded by foreign money inflows. What it means is that these economies will continue to slow, as in Japan, already in recession again, or will increasingly slip towards stagnation, as is the case in Europe. And already, the International Monetary Fund are saying, "Oh, global economy is slowing, slowing. Please, Donald Trump, don't engage in a trade war because we're slowing already." Well, we're going to have an increased gap between interest rates in the U.S. and in the other advanced economies, and that means money capital will continue to flow out of Europe and Japan, and slowing their real economies. Against this trend in Europe, of course, we have the Italian debt crisis erupting, as we've talked about, as the new populist party, Five Star, takes over the government, and begins to issue warnings and maneuver that it's not happy with the Eurozone arrangement, where they don't have control over the central bank, and therefore over a currency that they could devalue to stimulate their exports in their economy. They can't do that. You can't do that in the Eurozone, you see. Well, bond prices are beginning to rise, bond rates rather, rise again in Italy, a sign of growing concern, political risk. Some of the new members of the government, they're warning that they're not going to abide by the fiscal cap of the Eurozone. In other words, a freeze that said you can't spend on programs, social programs, more than 3.5% of your budget each year, which is a form of austerity threshold, you see. That's what that fiscal threshold is all about, which means everything will be driven by monetary policy by the ECB, which is controlled by the Germans and their allies in Northern Europe. Well, the whole southern tier of Europe is increasingly concerned about that loss of sovereignty and economic control. The most severe case, of course, was Greece. Greece was the microcosm of this kind of financial imperialism within the Eurozone. I wrote a book, Looting Greece. Read the reviews on my blog and website, jackrasmus.com, from various sources, which is really about defining what this new financial imperialism is really about and how financial imperialism works. It works at the state government level, and it's the more powerful economic state, supranational state in Europe, for example, dominated by the Germans, which indebts the periphery economies and then requires austerity programs in those economies to pay the interest on the debt, which never ends and keeps going. And that's what happened to Greece. Greece is the worst case scenario of that. And then in 2015, this populist party called Syriza comes along, says it's going to change that, but then collapses in 6 months and becomes the vehicle of more austerity in Greece. Well, we got the Five Star Movement now. We'll see what the Five Star Movement does. Is it going to go the way of Syriza and become the handmaiden for the Northern European banks and their governments, squeezing them, squeezing Italy, or will it move in a direction of more independence from that monetary policy vice that exists in the Eurozone, squeezing the periphery? Well, there's some signs, for example, that the new five-star government has plans to create some kind of an alternative currency. We'll watch that. Although the Eurozone, the Northern Eurozone, made sure it has a foothold in Italian policy and made sure that the finance minister in Italy was going to be one of their boys, which he is, right? So we got this big fight going to go on over fiscal and monetary policy in Italy, which is a reprise, a reprise of what happened in Greece. Well, Syriza in Greece collapsed. Will Five Star in Italy be able to break that trend? Well, we will see. Unknown so far. Interesting to watch. Well, just watch the bonds, Italian bonds, as the rate, bond rate rises. What you're going to That's an indicator that the Five Star and the populism is prevailing. All right, we'll see. Oh, by the way, so what about the Greek debt crisis? What about looting of Greece? Well, there's a lot of hype now in the media, in Europe and the US, saying that the last Greek debt deal of 2015, which comes to an end this August and needs renegotiation, right? That the Greek debt crisis is over, that Greece is finally emerging and recovering from the debt crisis of 2015, which was their third crisis, by the way, because they had one in 2012 and another one in 2010. Right? Greece is being taken off, quote, life support. By whom? Well, by what's called the Troika, the European Economic Commission, or European Commission, European Central Bank, and the IMF together in 2015 put up, I don't know, $85 billion of new debt to pay the old debt that Greece had accumulated as a result of the 2012 crisis, debt crisis, when the Troika stepped in and paid off the private investors, bond investors, and indebted Greece to it, the Troika, government, super government funds. That's what 2012 was all about. You know, pay off the private investors so they can take their money and run, and Greece would then owe the Troika, Europe, right? So that was 2012. In 2015, when they had to renegotiate it, the Troika had stepped in and gave them another 80 billion to recycle the money. In other words, more debt just to pay the interest and principal on the old debt. That's what the game's all about. And all this interest and principal just keeps flowing back to the banks in Northern Europe. Yes, to the banks. Because the Troika really borrows from the banks to give to Greece. Then the payments go to the Troika, goes to the banks. Studies in Germany have shown that 95% of all the interest payments on the Greek debt over the years have gone to German and Northern European banks, you see. So the banks are sucking out financial value, financial investment, principal and interest on debt. That's what the new financial imperialism is. It's debt-based. It's government-to-government based on behalf of the banks based. And you pay for it with austerity. You pay for it with workers' wages being cut, their jobs being cut, their pensions being cut, selling off government assets, and so on and so forth. Well, you know, the leader of Syriza here, this guy, Alex Tsipras, says, oh, we're at a historic moment now. We're emerging from the debt. No, you're not emerging from the debt. You are just moving the money around. In other words, instead of owing and getting money to pay the debt to the Troika, the government, super government euro agencies, now Greece will be able to go back into private bond markets and borrow there. So they're just moving the debt from the ECB and so forth over to private investors. Just like in 2012, they moved it from private investors to the Troika. Look at Greece today. Its gross domestic product is barely growing. And like the rest of Europe, slowing down. Household income is down 33%. Unemployment is still above 20%. And the jobs that have been created, a few percent jobs, have been a part-time, low-pay, contingent temp jobs like everywhere else in Europe. Pension cuts are continuing. Debt is still 180% of gross domestic product, over $300 billion. There's no debt payoff here. They're not emerging out of anything. In fact, the whole deal has been extended for 10 more years. In other words, Greece is going to be paying principal and interest on all this money loaned to it for 10 more years. Oh, they get to go to the private markets and borrow there to pay for it. That's all that's changed. You know, Syriza has become a handmaiden of the Troika. It's the bill collector for the Troika. That's all it is. And it's been going on since late 2015, when the leader of the party, Alex Tsipras, caved in. You know, he actually had a vote, a referendum, whether we should pay the Troika. And the Greek people said no. And he said, well, okay, I'm going to ignore it, and agreed to it. And the progressive elements that had joined Syriza, thinking that some change would occur, were purged. So what you got was this rump party called Syriza, which blocked with the pro-Euro business conservative party and kept the debt payments going and the austerity to make the debt payments going. And last week, the Syriza parliament once again cut pensions, once again started selling off more private assets, public assets, you know, airports and water companies and bus companies and so forth, right? So nothing's changed in Greece, except you got a different payees, you know, same bill collectors. Right. Now they're turning to private markets, and they have the gall to say that, oh, you know, the Greek debt crisis is over. We're recovering. Well, lots of strikes going on in Greece now. You don't hear much of that because the media doesn't like to talk about strikes because it gives other people ideas that maybe that's a good idea. Let's do it. All right, so another topic here we've talked about in previous weeks is an addendum to it, is this whole idea of the gig economy and contingent economy, contingent labor, meaning part-time, temp, independent, contract, on-call, etc., workers. And in a previous show, we talked about the Bureau of Labor Statistics, U.S. Labor Department, a study that came out here earlier this spring that said, the contingent labor force has not grown over the last 13 years or 12 years. It's still only about 10% of the labor force. You know, the labor force in this country is about 160 million people working or unemployed looking for work. And the BLS study said, the latest said, it's only 10.1%, which compares to 2005, last previous study of 10.7%. So it hasn't grown. But, you know, as we criticized, and by the way, you can read my piece on jackrasmus.com, printed version of this, my blog, the study was faulty. First of all, it excluded all gig jobs. There were software-based assignment jobs, all the Ubers and Lyfts and B&Bs and TaskRabbits and so forth. It even said so itself. We're not including the gig economy. But even so, for the other contingent jobs, it only counted workers whose primary first job was contingent or alternate work, as they call it, alternate work. Right? Only the first job. Well, we know that a lot of these other jobs, these alternate work jobs are, for a lot of people, are secondary jobs. You know, a lot of the Uber drivers, 69% of them, by the way, right, have these alternate work jobs as their second job. And there's hundreds of thousands of Uber drivers. I don't know the exact number. I've seen, you know, between 300 and 800,000, right? So all of them, 69% of them, have these jobs as secondary jobs, and they're excluded, right? Well, the addendum here today is that there was an interesting article in the Wall Street Journal on June 13th by an economist, Ms. Palagashvili, who revealed the faulty assumptions in this BLS study, one of which was that this BLS number of 10.1% is a ratio of the total alternative employment, excluding gig, of course, to the labor force. The labor force is 160 million, right? And you find a number for alternative, and 16 million is about 10.1%, right, of the labor force. Well, the problem with that, as Ms. Palagashvili points out, is that if the denominator of the labor force increases in the ratio, then the number of alternative jobs will decrease as well. And, of course, the labor force continues to grow. Population continues to grow, and the labor force continues to grow, particularly in recent years. Now, a lot of those jobs are part-time, contingent, low-pay jobs, most of them. But nonetheless, they are jobs, and they are added to the number in the labor force. So as the denominator grows, the ratio declines, and therefore it looks like there's no real growth in alternative work arrangements, when actually there may be. Well, certainly is. A study by Princeton professors Katz and Kruger here a year or so ago showed that alternative work jobs have increased 50% since 2005. So that would mean that, you know, there's probably a 15-16% of the U.S. workforce, 160 million, that are in these alternative contingent work relationships, which means instead of 16 million, you probably got close to 25 million. Growing very fast, right? Another source of problem in the BLS study that Palagashvili points out is that there's a sampling bias. The numbers that the BLS comes up with are based on phone interviews, phone surveys, the monthly BLS phone surveys. Well, the phone surveys excludes, there's problems with the phone surveys, excludes large categories of workers. Read my article explaining that, right? that, by the way, the Katz-Kruger study did not exclude. So the sampling differences between the government BLS and the private Princeton study is significant. Big, big problem. You know, go read her article. Wall Street Journal, June 13th, page 21, worth a read, relatively short. You know, these numbers are statistics, as I've say. What's a statistic? It's not a real number in the sense of a raw data. This is the actual number of alternative work, contingent workers, you know. You would think that's called a census, you know, to go out and find out exactly how many there are. A statistic is a manipulation on a raw data. Well, we see this ratio is a manipulation. That's what a statistic is. That's how you define statistics, an operation on raw data. And the number doesn't necessarily reflect true numbers of actual amount. of alternative jobs. Okay. Well, that's just the, you know, the ongoing stuff. Well, what about the trade war? Let's get back to the trade war, right? Trump's trade war, as I've been saying, there's a two-track trade war going on. One track is a phony trade war with U.S. allies and partners, and the other is a possible real trade war with China. It all has to do, a lot of it has to do with domestic politics and Trump pumping up his political domestic base with his America First economic nationalism bullshit that did so well for him in his 2016 election. He's trying to look aggressive to that political domestic base. And he's doing it by, you know, going after not just China, but apparently, you know, NAFTA and so forth, and Europe, Korea, Japan. And, of course, he used the steel aluminum tariffs as the main issue to set this whole thing in motion. Well, you know, the NAFTA agreements were almost resolved here. A month or so ago, U.S. And Mexico and Canada, but then Trump stepped in and blew it up. They almost had an agreement, but he blew it up purposely. He does not want an agreement right now. He wants it right before the election. There will be a NAFTA agreement before the election in November, U.S. midterms. The same thing with Europe. You know, he's picking a fight with Europe. He's picking a fight with Germany, right? Because he doesn't like what Merkel's doing here politically. And Germany's not coming on board with U.S. foreign policy, you know, whether it's in Syria or whether it's, you know, somewhere else on immigration, et cetera, right? Merkel is the persona non grata for Trump here. You know, you could see he brings this French president Macron over, you know, he feasts him and feeds him and everything, and even allows him to speak to Congress. Big deal, you know. And then soon as Macron leaves, Merkel comes over. You don't hear anything. He doesn't have anything. He lets her come into the White House. He talks with her, sends her home. Yeah. Most important economy in Europe. All right. So, you know, he's picking a fight with them over there. But that's going to get resolved too. And look, I think Mexico, Canada, and Europe kind of know that. I mean, look at the counter tariffs. Europe imposes $3 billion, you know, in response to U.S. tariffs. And Mexico, even less than $3 billion. Those are token responses for the domestic political basis. They're not real, you know? I think this is going to be resolved with the allies. Look at South Korea, softball deal on tariffs. And the real battle is with China. And the real issue there is tech transfer, technology transfer. That's what the fight is over, because next-gen technologies, artificial intelligence, cybersecurity, 5G, are military technologies. And that's what the U.S. is really concerned about with China. They'll never get an agreement unless they get agreement on that with China, and China will never agree to that. China will agree to give more access to U.S. companies. China will agree to buy more agricultural goods, but it will not give up technology, and the U.S. will insist it does. Well, that's where the real trade war will come from. And if you don't believe me, read Peter Navarro's latest editorial in the Wall Street Journal on June 21st, which says, "It's technology, stupid." Navarro's the hardliner anti-Chinese guy in the trade team in the U.S. Okay, we'll watch the trade war with China, which is very real and possible, and the phony war with the rest. All right, that's it. Walk the streets, they're screaming now.